before we get started, I want to remind you once again that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, is now for sale. You can get it at the website, thecommentarytrack.com. Click on the videos page, and then you'll see the image there, and it'll take you to PayPal, and Bob's your uncle. So I hope you'll order 2 or 10, and let's get on with the show.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 46 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. Exotic, alluring, unscrupulous. Much like Myrna Loy in Renegades. Go find it. You know, I always enjoy talking with my guest on the Commentary Track, almost always. There's been an exception or two, but why dwell on the past? But I have rarely felt as out of my league as when I talked with today's guest, Ben Burt. Ben is a sound designer, but he's also much, much more than that. He's directed films, he's edited films, he's provided the voices for some of the great characters in Star Wars, which was the first film he worked on. He's a multiple Academy Award winner. He's been nominated for many more Oscars and has won almost every other kind of award you can give to somebody in the movie business. He's also one of the greatest guys ever, as knowledgeable about film history as anybody I know, and just a pleasure to be around. I am so grateful I've gotten to know him over the past few years. I was introduced to him through our mutual friend, Craig Barron, who will be coming up on the, if not the next episode of the Commentary Track, at least very, very soon. And the two of them do these great programs at the Academy where they'll pick a film and Craig will talk about the visual history of the film and Ben will talk about the sound history of the film. And these things are always great to see. It's the last time I saw them do a show, they were with Jerry Lewis. They just discussed his career as a director, not really as a movie star or as a comedian, but simply as a filmmaker. And it was fascinating, and Jerry was great fun, and it was a wonderful evening. So not only did I enjoy talking with Ben, but the setting didn't hurt either. My wife and I went up to Skywalker Ranch in Marin County. He gave us the grand tour of the place, and man, oh man, what a wonderful place that is. Now, I'm sure that there are many people who are unhappy to be working there. I can't even imagine it, though, because it's like a little slice of paradise. And we had such a great time. We spent the greater part of that day there, and Ben showed us all over the place, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. So thank you to Ben for that. You know, I often make little notes of things that I want to talk to people about. And on most occasions, when I walk out, I think, we covered everything I wanted to talk to him about. In this case, not even close. So many things. Because this is a career that you don't get to talk about it in an hour and a half. It just much, 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 much more involved than that. I even forgot to ask him about Lincoln, which is a big deal for me. And I wrote on a piece of paper, just as I was walking out the door from home, Wilhelm Scream. And I forgot to ask him about that. Those of you who know what the Wilhelm Scream is will know what it is. And if you don't know what it is, you will find out the next time Ben is on the show. And I promise you, he will be back. So, enjoy this terrific interview with the even more terrific Ben Burt. And I'll see you on the other side.
I never considered having a career in motion pictures as a child or growing up. It was only after college that this whole thing came about, kind of through a series of coincidences. And I trained in school to be a science teacher. That's what I wanted to be. And I went through college and got a degree in physics with in the back of my mind, I thought maybe I could be an astronaut. So that's kind of where I thought I was headed. Science, maybe teaching, being an astronaut, something like that. If we go way back and say what happened, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, upstate New York. My parents were both professors at Syracuse University. My grandparents were also professors at Ohio State. So I was kind of destined to be a teacher, I think, from the environment that I grew up in. This is in the 1950s, I was a child of the first generation of television, growing up seeing things, everything from Howdy Doody to the Lone Ranger, and I love Saturday morning cartoons, and of course, my exposure to motion pictures was what I saw on the two local TV channels, just whatever package of films they rented. And from an early age, I was very interested in movies, watching movies, particularly Westerns when I was a kid. And although I never considered it as a career, it was I spent a lot of time watching films. And that was my first, and I had an interest in movies, not as a career. But what happened along the way was interesting. When I was 6 years old, I was very sick with an infection, and I was home from school for a couple of weeks recovering and bedridden. And my father, who was looking for things for me to do, he brought home from the university a tape recorder. Now, it was a big thing, and I almost took two people to carry it in those days. And it was a high-tech piece of equipment, and he plunked it down next to my bed. And he showed me how to record with it and talk into the microphone. And he just brought it because it was something I could do while I was kind of tied up in my bedroom. And so I was introduced to sound recording. And, of course, I was the only kid on the block. I was the only kid in my town that had a tape recorder. So it was really a high-tech, almost magical piece of equipment. And I began recording my own voice and, then I discovered that I could record television shows. I could hold the mic up to the speaker on the TV and record a show, a cartoon or a movie. And I discovered a love for listening to the films that I saw on television and shows. I'd record a show. I guess it's kind of like we used to do when people recorded VHS tape. You know, you recorded video and sure. Play it back. I could play back just the sound. And I listened to it, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I was building up this inventory in my head of what movies sounded like. And I really enjoyed listening because I could then imagine the movie all over again, and it almost became a form of interactive entertainment because I could listen to the adventures of Robin Hood over and over again and get very familiar with the music and the dialogue and the sounds. And so it was really a hobby of mine to record and stockpile shows that I liked. And that's where it began. I began building a shelf of tapes in my bedroom of shows that I was interested in. And I was, as I was listening to all of these, I didn't realize it, but I was getting very familiar with how motion picture soundtracks are constructed. You know, what role the music plays. What role the sound effects play in creating the story and adding drama. That's really this hobby of mine, which I had several hobbies, is where it began.
Now, when did it come to you that you wanted to go into making movies yourself?
Well, when I was around 10 years old, actually, I took my father's 8mm movie camera, which is, you know, our home movie camera. And with his help, you know, technically, he had to show me how to load the film and all of that. I got together with a couple of friends, and we made a film. I loved make-believe. I loved dressing up in costumes. And, of course, as boys growing up at that time, we played war, and we were cowboys, and we were soldiers, and we were always off having some adventure with our toy guns or whatever, my rubber knives, whatever boys, you know,
sure.
Played with. And we had this idea, well, actually, we could make a little movie and capture something we wanted to do. And so we made a film, a short film. It was really more of a comedy called The Window Washer. And it was just me washing some windows. So I'll pretend, you know, we had a little we drew a window and on paper and cut it out and stuck it on the wall. And I was washing it, and I then lose my balance and fall off this high building. And we had a little army man we dropped, you know, from a ladder that you see him plunging toward the ground. We we drew out what looked like a map of streets, and he hits, and then later he goes to the doctor, and he gets all bandaged up, so he looks like a mummy, and he walks out of the doctor's office, and a couple people on the street see him, and they say, "It's a Mars man," and they run for their lives, and that was the end of the movie. So it was the beginning of an interesting period with my friends. I had three friends that we got together as a little team. And we started writing little scenarios and making movies as teenagers. None of us ever looked at it as a career. It was just a way, to be honest, of prolonging our childhood, that we could dress up in costume and, you know, bayonet one another and enjoy putting it on film and showing it to our families.
Did you keep those films?
I have all of those films. We shot 8mm films, and then we moved on to Super 8 when that format arrived. And of course, back at that time, we had to, we had to light the scenes. Film was not very sensitive, so shooting indoors required learning how to light and get some lights. And also, of course, you could not record sound. There was no way of capturing sync sound with those film formats. So with my knowledge and my the availability of the tape recorder, I had it. By this time, I had two or three tape recorders. My father realized I was very interested in recording, and I'd gotten one as a gift. We were able to fashion, after the fact, a track for our movies. I could take a music cue from a record. We would watch the movie and hold a microphone, and we would try to do some dialogue. And if it was a sword fight, we'd get a couple of swords and bang them together. We kind of followed this history of motion pictures in its own way. We tried to, you know, add sound and synchronize it as we went. And you ended up having a Super 8 film, which didn't have any sound on the film itself, but you had a tape recorder with a tape. And so when you showed the movie to your, you know, friends and relatives, which was our entire audience, you'd have to start the two together, the projector and the tape recorder, and then you sort of put your thumb on either one to slow one down if something got ahead. This is where I learned synchronization, you know. I learned it in the field in the worst conditions. But since I could put sound to my little films, that added a dimension that just nobody else had, you know, that we could have a, you know, big main title music and music supporting the fight scenes and all of that sort of thing. So it had a big impact when I showed these films to my family and, as I say, groups of friends that would come over to the house.
You were replicating what was going on at Warner Brothers in 1927 and 28, right?
I didn't know it at the time. Yeah. That's totally true. We were kind of in the jazz singer era. You know, we were trying to discover ourselves and how we could put sound to these movies. You know, a few years later, when I got into college, Super 8 came now with a mag track on a film, and you could shoot sync sound, even though you got the whir of the camera.
Yeah.
Pretty loud. So we sort of moved into that as our next step. And our big success, and once again, this was just a hobby. We had done a science fiction film called The Prisoner, which was more or less inspired by the Patrick McGoohan TV show, which we loved.
Yeah.
And we emulated that a little bit and made a film called The Prisoner and entered that in the Kodak student film contest, and we got an honorable mention. And that propelled us along to our first, I'm going to call, feature, which was about 40 minutes long when it was done. We made our version of Wings and Dawn Patrol.
Wow.
And it was a big idea. The movie was called Yankee Squadron. And it involved, trying to create World War I. Aerial battles and ground battles and everything of this sort. And it took us about 3 years to do it. We worked in the summertime when we were out of school, and on weekends when we didn't work, you know, we got together in costumes and we'd go to a location and we'd try to figure out how to do this movie. So it took a couple of years, and it wasn't actually until just the end of college, because we were pretty busy, all of us in school, that I finished the film. I'm editing it, you know, as I went along. And we entered it and won the National Student Film Festival first prize with it. And the judges were Pauline Kael and Richard Schickel.
Wow.
And Fred Wiseman. And they invited me to come to New York just to meet me because they really liked this film. And they kind of encouraged me to make movies. They said, don't even go to film school. Just, you know, follow this this path. And so I noted that, of course, that great encouragement. But I was still headed to my direct. I was in science, and I was just finishing college in physics. And I didn't think a film career would made sense. I wasn't sure how I could combine my love of science and my love of fantasy. They're kind of two different worlds. But a very interesting thing happened to me when I was in college, my last year, as I was trying to solve this dilemma in my head, where should I go? Should I work in movies or should I be a scientist? Arthur C. Clarke came to my college. I went to Allegheny College, a small, excellent school in northwestern Pennsylvania. He came, he was on a speaking tour, you know, at the time 2001 had come out, and he was going around, not really talking about that movie, but talking about his science fiction writings as well as scientific ideas and things that were reality. He came to our school, and I was detailed, assigned to be his escort for the day because I was the only physics major in my class. So here I was with Arthur C. Clarke alone, shepherding him around campus. And when I met him, we had a couple hours before he gave his talk, and I asked him a few questions about how they did the special effects in 2001, because, you know, at that time there's no books about behind the scenes. And he got in the lecture hall, and I was the only person sitting in the lecture hall, and he went up to the blackboard and he started explaining the slit scan machine and motion control and mat work. And I realized, I got so inspired by this. Here was a man that was a scientist, but he had combined his love of science and scientific pursuits with science fiction and then movie making. And so he had bridged these two worlds. And I was so encouraged and so excited by what he showed me and just the trick photography in 2001. And he explained it kind of, you know, technically. And I walked away from that day with him, feeling, you know, I could do this. I could somehow combine my interest in movie making, which includes sound, with my interest in science. Maybe I can make scientific documentaries or something like that, or who knows. So I felt after I graduated and got my degree from Allegheny, well, maybe I should take some time and really learn filmmaking skills just to see what it's all about, because I hadn't had any formal training. So I applied to film schools, and while I was a year or two in doing that, I made an animated film. I got very interested in special effects, and so I made a film about the creation of the universe called Genesis, and I built all kinds of apparatus to do front projection, rear projection, mat work, slit scan. I did it all in my basement. I built little sets, moon bases and things of this sort. And it essentially was a little science fiction movie showing off some real, interesting, well, low budget visual effects done in 16 millimeter. And I entered that film into a contest and won a scholarship to go to film school. And, from there I went to USC. And it took me to the West Coast.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Did you give up the idea of working in science right away, or did you?
My expectations were I would go to Los Angeles because I thought that would be a place to observe and learn, you know, the filmmaking trade, especially at USC Cinema Department. Maybe I'll spend a year or two doing that. I'll get my master's degree and then I'll come back and be a science teacher. that was my 2 year, my 3 year plan, that I really wasn't, you know, committed to the idea that I would work in the Hollywood industry, but but I wanted to know more about it, and I was young enough to, and felt, well, I have time to, you know, and somebody's investing in this, I can do it. You know, I can spend a couple of years on this, pursuing something a little different. And so I did. I went out to USC and, never came back, basically. Many things happened at that point, which led me down the path, to where I am today.
Now, what specifically were you studying at USC? Just all forms of filmmaking?
Well, you have a decision there to be a major in production or in scholarship or history, writing. And I opted to learn about production. So you get classes in cinematography and in sound and in production management. The great thing about USC at that time, and I presume it's still true, is you'd be assigned to be on a crew making a film. It might be a 3-man crew. It might be a 5-man crew. And you'd just be assigned. You're the editor. You're the director or writer. And you just have to do it. And you'd have a semester to write or create a film. Or if you're the editor, you were the editor. And it was a great way to learn movie making because you had to commit to finishing something. You had to work on a certain budget to get it done. If you were the script writer, you had to get your script approved by the department, you know, faculty. It was frustrating at first because they just didn't let you make any film. They wanted to change your script or something. But I realized after the fact that this was just like real Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sell your idea, you know, pitch your idea, and then you had to work within a budget and a time frame and work with the crew. You just weren't an auteur. You know, most film students, myself included at that point, felt that, well, I just want to write, act, and star and, you know, direct my own movies. And that's all. I'm an auteur right now. And soon you learn that that kind of opportunity is rare and isn't really typical of how movies are made. Movies are made by a crew of people, you're delegating responsibilities, and you also have a, you know, like a studio hovering over you, you know, wanting to change your ideas, and you got to kind of fight back. And the experience at USC emulated really what I didn't know it until later when I entered the industry, that it simulated it very well.
Now, you already had a love of so let's call it classic film,
yeah,
from growing up. Was that something that you pursued at USC? Did you seek out films?
Yes.
To watch? And were there particular directors or other filmmakers that really you clung to?
Well, you know, I came to USC being very naive of film history. Those of us that grew up in the 1950s and 60s, you know that there were very few books about,
yeah,
movie making. And there weren't books written about particular directors and their styles. I mean, you might find something on Hitchcock in a magazine or an article on John Ford, maybe. But the behind-the-scenes crafts, there was no resources for learning sound, editing, or visual effects. You had to just the great thing about USC at that time was they had – they had maybe 6 screening rooms on campus that ran 35 millimeter. And they had arrangements with the studios to get studio prints, not only for films that were being premiered at the time, you know, and you'd see them a week ahead of time maybe, but they had access to the studio archives. I knew nothing about Howard Hawks or William Wellman because I'd seen almost none of their films growing up. There was no opportunity, as you know, unless you rented a 16-millimeter print. I should mention that when I was back at Allegheny, I was briefly film chairman for the Sunday night movie at school. And I started, you know, it turns out what they wanted was Fellini and European films and independent films. But I was ordering things like The Seahawk and,
sure,
you know, Pit and the Pendulum and whatever, because I wanted to see these movies. And so I was pushed out of the Sunday night slot to Tuesday night where I could have my own show, and I would run serials and horror movies. And, you know, for instance, I had never seen The Seahawk as a complete movie. I'd seen it chopped up on television when we rented the 16 millimeter print, oh my gosh, there's a whole scene, there's a lot of it I've never seen before. And Robin Hood, The Adventures of Robin Hood, I'd never seen it in color. And I'd seen a release of it in 35, but it was black and white. And so I rented, I think, the Films Incorporated version, and there was this beautiful Technicolor IB print. I was just stunned with it, and we all watched it, and we were amazed how great that color looked and what a rich movie that was. So I was discovering these things, and at USC, they would show films every evening, and we were able to go. I used to go out to Warner Brothers on Friday afternoons, and we were allowed to pick out 4 films out of the vaults and take it home for the weekend and watch them. And I'd go into the vaults and I'd get, a stack of rusty cans, you know, they're just some 1,000-foot reels, and we'd get, you know, King Richard and the Crusaders or Charge of the Light Brigade or something, and take it back, and we would run it we had a nitrate booth at USC, and I was a trained projectionist by that time, and we would run 4 films every weekend for ourselves. And that's where I began to see things that were never available to me.
Sure.
I could discover, it's kind of about Turner Classic Movies of the day. And of course they were offering in their film classes, a lot of film history. So this is where I had a crash course in seeing things. But aside from that, you know, imagine this now, Frank, there were a lot of Hollywood, folks alive then that you'd love to talk to. We would have visits in class from Alfred Hitchcock. We had William Wellman on 2 occasions come down and talk about his career. You know, Clint Eastwood would show up and show Joe Kidd or something and talk about his experiences with Sergio Leone or something of that sort. I remember being a projectionist when we were showing a Clint Eastwood film. I think it was Joe Kidd. And he showed up with the print, you know, and the door opens of the booth and there's a silhouette of a guy with 2 film cans in either hand, and it's Clint Eastwood. He comes in with the print. And later he invited some of us to his house for dinner because of the screening. And so this was an amazing experience.
Yeah.
I could kill myself because I didn't know enough, because I was asked to introduce Howard Hawks at an event at school. And, you know, I had to sort of read about him a little bit, but I had not seen, you know, many Hawks films. And I wish I could have asked him questions that I was smart. I wasn't smart enough then to ask him things that he might have wanted to talk about. And because I was just learning. And so some of those opportunities are just, you know, I feel like there were losses to some extent. But it was a great setup because you'd see filmmakers there every week talking about their experiences showing a film. And that was how we learned. You know, you learned out of hearing anecdotes of how things, you know, Hitchcock was always pretty evasive. He would be a wise guy.
Yeah.
You know, he wouldn't tell you directly how to make a movie. He would just entertain you. Wellman, on the other hand, was filled with all of his stories. I'm sure that you heard them all because I think he had a repertoire of things.
Yeah.
And was, you know, the tough guy director and all of his, you know, experiences. But it was fascinating at that time.
Yeah, those guys were always interesting. Wellman, I never met.
Uh-huh.
I'm sad to say. But certainly I know all of his stories. And I also know how many of them are true and how many of them are not.
Right. I thought they were all true then. Yeah. And I just ate it up.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I often think, you have to go through the myth first before you get to, you know, it's the same with William Wellman as it is with the Alamo. You need the story first,
yeah,
and then you can dig out the truth.
Absolutely.
Because the myth inspires the passion.
And, exactly. You got the right impression from each one of these characters as to what his view was or how they thought of themselves,
yeah.
I guess, is what it is, their story. And that gave it flavor and color. And of course, as students, we were writing notes and we're taking it all down, like, you know, verbatim. You know.
Yeah, well, it's great that as you were learning to be a filmmaker, you were also learning the history of the form.
Absolutely.
I sometimes fear that that's going away. And maybe I'm being unduly pessimistic, but I'm finding a lot of people who aren't that interested in the past. And
sure.
That stuff, not only just as a guidepost to what you can do, it's also just fascinating in and of itself.
Absolutely. It opened up a whole world for me seeing film after film, uncut, you know, without commercials and things that you'd never have seen on television. And then I was a projectionist, so I was seeing other films because I was handling them. You know, I would go in and screen Gone with the Wind or something. I remember one time I was assigned to, they were going to run Gone with the Wind, and there was a print available that Selznick had in this Beacon's warehouse in downtown L.A., and I was detailed to go and get it. So I went to this Beacon's warehouse and went up in the elevator, you know, and it opens up, and it looks like the last reel from Citizen Kane, you know, with boxes and crates and things everywhere. And eventually they found this print, and I took it back, and it was a fantastic Technicolor nitrate print from, I'm guessing, 1939 or maybe the 40s.
Wow.
A pristine print of the film. And we took that back, and my hands trembled as I tried to put it in the gate, you know, because you just say, oh my gosh, you know, what if it breaks or something like this. But you get a chance to see a film that way on a big screen. In a vintage print, it's a very impressive, and they don't look the same as you see the film now.
Yeah.
And I remember we got Adventures of Robin Hood and ran it, so I got to see a 35mm nitrate Technicolor print, and it was amazing to see the richness of color, the contrast in the film. Obviously, the films are dyed. The colors are,
yeah,
essentially, it's a dyeing process where you can control the look to some extent or to a great extent. And it was eye-opening to see what those films really were meant to look like and sound like, too.
It's astonishing to me in terms of Technicolor, although the history goes back to the teens,
when
it really hit in the mid-30s, it was almost perfect right away. Because those first Technicolor films of the late 30s are all spectacular looking. I mean, they just are gorgeous.
Absolutely.
And so they got it right out of the gate. Sound, it took a while to really come into its own.
Yeah.
Several years, in fact, before it was really top-notch sound. By the, you know, 32, 33, it was good.
Right.
But color, almost right away, as soon as three-strip.
That's true.
Comes out.
Yeah, even Becky Sharp, which is the first one. I remember we ran a nitrate print of that, and it had a clever idea. I think I have this right. It starts out, you see sort of a gray curtain,
mm-hmm.
and you're not sure it's color or not. And then I think it opens up, and there's some soldiers in bright red British dress, you know, and it rocks the senses for a moment.
Yeah, I just watched Adventures of Robin Hood very recently, just in the past few weeks. And I think that's the real difference between color then and color now, is that by and large, people want color to either represent reality or they even subdue it a lot. I think we see a lot of
nowadays, kind of particularly
suppressed color.
Yeah, it's a style.
But you look at Robin Hood and every element of every frame is colored just as it should be, and there are, it's just like a rainbow. It's not like real life at all. It's this wonderful cake, you know.
It'd be wonderful to be able to see what was in front of camera, versus what is in the print, because there obviously there's as you're saying, they did put a lot of thought into what was in the frame and what color it was. You know, you'll have four knights standing there, and they each has a different color cape or blouse, and it's nicely coordinated and all of that. A lot of thought went into it. And it'd be interesting to know what it looked like live versus, say, because like any medium, oil painting versus watercolors, the three-strip Technicolor process, you know, is an interpretation of, and then the artist learns how to tweak that to get a particular feeling, a personal statement out of it. Because we don't really see those films today. We see excellent restorations of them, and I think the color is dazzling. I'm not sure it's exactly what people saw, but it's yet a new rendition of it.
I don't think so either. Especially in the early days of IB Technicolor, they would have charts that would say, this is the color we want this to be, so this is what we have to shoot.
Oh, yeah.
And so it would be a slightly different because they knew just because of the process, it would change it a little bit. And so now when they're doing restorations, I think a lot of times what's in the negative is different than what was in the prints.
Uh-huh,
you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so it's a little bit of a tricky path to walk because do you want to restore it to make the way it looked in 1938?
Uh-huh.
Or do you want to pull everything that's in the negative out of the negative and make it
right.
like that?
Sure.
And it's kind of a scary thing to contemplate because you can end up altering the very nature of the film.
Absolutely.
If you don't just, that's the kind of thing that keeps me awake at night.
So. You know, Craig and I have been looking at a lot of nitrate outtakes recently. Craig Barron and I do programs at the Academy, and we have been looking at outtakes from the Warner Brothers library of special effects work. Airplanes and things, and you see a lot of the wires and other things. These are HD captures now from a NIG, and things that you probably didn't see clearly in the days those films were released, because a print in the theater wouldn't have been as sharp as you can make it today.
Yeah,
you know, and so it does reveal a little more of the process behind it.
Yeah, and in a way, it's not fair to those films to suddenly reveal the flaws. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, it's true.
You know, it's like taking somebody's makeup off or something.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing, and now we run the risk of exposing it a little bit too much.
Yeah, they knew what the destination was going to be. In other words, that's the outcome in a theater. Not thinking people, 70 years later would be examining it with a microscope.
I remember several years ago when I worked at Disney, I was working with Scott McQueen, who is basically a genius at this sort of thing, really incredibly gifted at restoration and has as great an eye as anybody I know. But he was going through a little bit of that same thing restoring Snow White. This has been the mid-90s sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are actually details, say carvings on the beds, that in the original nitrate 1937 prints just were not visible.
Oh, yeah.
And so when you do find them, you think, well, that's a detail that's... Mm. Somebody drew that.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Uh-huh.
Is it... Do you really want to respect what 1937 had, or do you want to pull everything out of this that's there?
Sure.
And it's a dilemma. And I'm not quite sure even where I fall on that question, because I can be swayed either way, I think.
I think we have to accept that there will be an ongoing interpretation of the past because face it, how many nitrate projection booths are going to be? I don't think there's any of them. Maybe there's what, three or four around the country that can run a commercial film. And that's it. And then the prints, of course, are, delicate and they're not making new ones. So anything like that is going to be vintage and it's likely to be wearing out or breaking or something.
It's always a gift to be able to see a nitrate print, though.
Absolutely.
It is.
Even black and white, of course, as
it
we
is
know.
Different,
It's a whole different interpretation of the image.
But I also think as much as I've looked into this, and I'm no technician, I only know what I know, but I think another thing is because nitrate duped very poorly.
Oh, yeah.
And so...
Yeah.
Whenever you're seeing a nitrate print, you're seeing original camera negative.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing straight from the negative. And I think that's one of the reasons, they always talk about the silver content and all that, which might have something to do with it. But I think direct from camera negative is one reason that these prints are so vibrant and why they remain different. Because even when you get into the 30s, you start doing more internegs and more steps away from camera negative.
Yes, exactly.
And by the time now you make, it's a completely different can of fish now, but in when they were still making films, when it's still using film to show, the print could be several steps away from the negative.
Yes, right.
Yeah, so it's something. I remember watching, what's that Ron Howard film about the Colorado land rush, or the Oklahoma land rush.
Oh, yeah.
Far and Away.
Far and Away, right.
They shot it in 70 millimeter.
Yeah.
Shot it in 65. And they were trumpeting how great it was that they were doing one. When I saw it, I thought, hey, it doesn't look that great. But then uh-huh. when you think about it, it was probably 12 steps away from the negative.
Yes. And,
whereas when you look at, say, Oklahoma,
uh-huh.
you're going right there. I mean, it's
yeah. It is the duping process. I mean, this happens with sound as well, even worse. I mean, sound effects or any original sound recording made on the set is in the classic days is also duped. It was the sound was shot on film,
sure,
and so it had to be developed in the lab as a negative and printed, and then if you had made another printing master of some sort, the sound might go another generation, and so on. And by the time it reaches the home theater, the sound has gone numerous generations, and there's a tremendous buildup of noise or distortion or other problems unless you're very careful along the way. And, they don't talk a lot about the restoration of the audio tracks these days. There are many techniques for removing unwanted noise, the hiss and crackle that might be on because of dirt on the soundtrack. And that's been helpful. I haven't heard, the results seem to be very good on the films. They, make it to Blu-ray or a DCP. Except sometimes people tamper and change some of the sound effects, I've noticed, and that bugs me.
Yeah. Well, people are always monkeying with these things you gotta find a film, restorer that you can trust.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
everybody's an artist, right?
Yeah.
So they put something into it.
Well, you worked in the business when it was all film, and now you're working in the business when it's all digital. In terms of your day-to-day work, how is that different now from the way it used to be?
Well, in the world of being a sound designer, which is how I describe myself, the technology has completely changed. It's entirely digital, which means that once you put a microphone out and record something, it's captured as a digital signal, zeros and ones, we mm-hmm. say, on a file, on a drive. The probably one of the big advantages, there are several big advantages to the having the audio being digital. One is that generations, when you go from the original sound to a copy that you make, save in the library, then it gets into a pre-mix in the movie, and then it gets in the mix of the movie, and then it gets to a print, and then it goes to Blu-ray or whatever. There's usually at least 10 copies of the sound, if not more, by the time it reaches the listener. In the old days, that would really be difficult to maintain high quality with that many changes. But now, digitally, there's no degradation. And so that's a big advantage for us. We don't have to spend so much time being technically careful like we used to. And the other good thing about digital has been that the tools available for editing and for mixing are available. You can buy software and essentially do things on your laptop computer, you might say. One person can bring in front of him on the desk all these tools that used to require rooms and large crews and even truckloads of equipment, being offloaded, and you needed a lot of people to maintain it and everything. So from the artist's standpoint, I can do a lot of my sound design work alone, do it my way, you might say. You can make mistakes by, say, bringing the laptop to bed at night and trying to do your work, and your wife says, "What are you doing?" That's bad. You should keep it at work.
Sure.
But, it's the convenience of it is quite nice. And it has made, for instance, making your artistic statement a lot more efficient. There are many people that argue that digital doesn't sound as good as analog recording. that argument seems to be dying down a little bit now. They are different. It's the difference between watercolors and oil painting.
Sure.
I mean, anytime you capture a sound, the medium, I mean, the method by which you're capturing it is going to affect the kind of quality of it. And so you can argue that certain things don't sound the same, and that's true. But the convenience of digital and the overwhelming, of course, technical revolution of everything being done on a keyboard and a mouse,
yes. You
just can't resist that. You can't fight that. So all of our moviolas and all of our analog equipments and splicers that used to, you know, you cut your hand at work, you develop better muscles in the old days because you're winding film all the
yes.
time. You know, now it's you're lazy. You're just sitting there with a mouse click. I miss those things. And I still actually do some analog work because I like the quality of it. I still have my Nagra tape recorder, which is a really beautiful reel-to-reel tape recorder, portable, that you can go out and record things with. And it has a different sound than going out with a digital device. And I would use the analog methods when I think it's important, you know, explosions or jet planes or something like that. The analog stuff is actually much more interesting form of recording, and it's more useful in a movie soundtrack. I might bring up the subject that there is a language of sound in motion pictures. You know, there's a way of doing things that has come to us from motion pictures. A lot of us, especially those that grew up in my time period, we heard more things in the movies, like explosions and war and thunderclaps and face punches or things of this sort. We heard them in movies and not in real life. So we believe that the sounds in movies are what the appropriate sounds for what things should sound like. And all of those sounds in the early days, of course, were recorded optically. They were a photograph of a sound modulation. And that has this quality you can't get when you record something digitally.
Sure.
You can't make it sound like an old Humphrey Bogart movie. You have to actually use some old techniques in order to make it have that kind of voice quality or sound effects quality or music quality. And I go back often and try to record certain sounds by using older methods because I just want that older vintage sound. You end up putting it on digital for release, but if you can still follow it analog along the way, you get a certain sound. It's not available otherwise.
Sure. I wanted to backtrack a little bit because we left you in college.
Yes, right.
So I wanted to come up to what your first professional.
Sure. While I was at USC, I was there for 4 years finishing my master's degree. It got to a point where I also needed to pay for my life and I got started seeking outside work. A number of us, you know, we had some training in film post-production. We found, a couple of us got, little job offers to do some sound editing for little backwater companies in Hollywood that wanted cheap labor. And so, you know, some students wanted to be a director right away and get their script, you know, bought by a major studio. And others of us thought, well, we just want to get employment. We have to pay our rent. And so a few of us started getting part-time work cutting sound for some trailers. I was feeding New World Pictures sounds for their trailers. There was Joe Dante,
yeah,
who was cutting trailers at New World at that time. Someone introduced me to him, and he needed some sounds for some of the trailers they were doing at New World, and so I started making sounds. So some of the first sounds I ever made were for a film called Death Race 2000, the first version of it.
I know it well.
Yeah, and I was making, officially that's the first time I made a sound that got into a feature film.
And what was the sound?
The sounds of the cars. The sound, okay. I mean, I started making the sounds for the trailer first because Joe needed something. And then once they heard some of the things I was doing, making these high speed, unusual, futuristic cars, then they began to feed some of that into the actual completion of the movie. And, I don't think I got any screen credit for that. I think it's blank there, but I was so excited that I could go and see a movie and hear some sounds that I had conceived.
And how did you do those?
Well, I took the approach which later helped me a lot in Star Wars, which is I made most of the cars out of high-speed aircraft.
Hmm.
You know, P-51s and World War II fighters that went screaming by. And at that time, I hadn't recorded any because I had no way to go out and ask someone to fly their airplane. I was just pulling library material that was available. But using it, speeding it up and adding some phasing kind of a processing to it so it sounded futuristic. And then putting that sound in for the cars, you know, seemed to work. It made the cars kind of a combination of engine and jet in a way. And, that was the illusion. And it seemed to work. So that was kind of the first thing. And there was another film called Hollywood Boulevard, which was done at that time. I made sounds for that. And actually I ended up making some sounds for Russ Meyer for a couple of his films.
Hmm.
Those
would be easy to find.
Yeah. They were much simpler. Not proud of that, but, you know, at the time it was exciting to get a little paycheck for something. And I remember going up to, a place on Hollywood, somewhere on Sunset, and seeing for the first time sound editors at work. And it didn't exactly meet my expectations, but, you know, it was like a little sweatshop, and they open the door and there's this room full of moviolas, which are the, you know, machines used to cut and splice film. And there's half a dozen men in there cutting away with little rolls of film. And it looked like a sweatshop kind of thing. And it was hardly glamorous. Some guy yells to the other guy, "Hey, Bob, you know, send me that roll, a porno breathing number 5 or something." The guy tosses it across the room, and, you know, I didn't end up working there, but that was my first time looking on some sound editors. And I got a job also at a place called Graphic Films of Hollywood that was a documentary company doing films for the Jet Propulsion Lab, films on the Mars missions. And they were doing films with Carl Sagan before he was known, you know, nationally. And I got a job there as an editor, cutting sound effects and even doing a little picture cutting. And that was, obviously a good experience because they were a legitimate film company doing serious documentaries. And that was good to participate in that. I went to the Jet Propulsion Lab on a couple of shoots to do sound. I was, in fact, there the night that the first Viking lander landed on Mars. And I was the sound man in mission control, miking the different scientists at their workstations as the lander made its landing and then their first pictures coming through.
Wow.
And that was here I was combining science once again, you know, with my interest in filmmaking. And so that was quite a nice experience to see history like that and to witness it. And, I remember I had lavalier mics, you know, hidden on some of the scientists, their radio mics. So they forgot that they're being recorded. And so they would, you know, I'd even get them going to the men's room, you know, but you'd also hear their private conversations of, you know, one guy called his wife and said something, he wasn't sure it was going to work or land. And, you know, there was some real history there.
Yeah.
And, I still have those tapes today. It's, they're just archived away. And some of it was used in a documentary about the landing, you know, but so I had that experience. And I worked a few other places. I'm trying to think right now what other early sounds I did. I have to think for a minute, Frank. Sorry.
Well, you must have gotten to Lucas pretty soon after that, right? I mean,
I did, but
that was a big step up from Russ Meyer.
It was. Yeah, what happened there was they ran a class at USC. The SMPTE ran, you know, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers had a Tuesday night class that you could attend. You couldn't get credit for it, but they would have a program. And they'd spent a year doing special effects, and they would bring in different people in the industry like Linwood Dunn, you know, to explain matte painting, or actually they had Albert Whitlock came down for matte painting, and Linwood Dunn for the optical printer. And I would attend those meetings, and one of the other people that would come was Gary Kurtz, who was to be the producer on the first set of Star Wars movies. And I had I had a little acquaintance with Gary because he was just coming to these meetings. He knew my name. And also at the time, I was a teaching assistant in the sound department at USC. What had happened was because I had such a interest in sound and sound effects that most students did not, that had been recognized in the department, and I had a job helping other students mix their movies and make sounds for them, because there wasn't anyone else really taking on that task, and I was very interested in doing that. And in addition to that, USC had inherited a room full of old nitrate film, which was the remnants of the RKO sound effects library.
Wow.
Which had been, someone had kept it in a vault in Seward Street in Hollywood, and there was all this nitrate optical film. And it was cataloged. It was a partial collection, but it was the remains of their collection, and they wanted somebody to catalog it and transfer it to tape and save it. And so I took on that job because it was the whole summer job I could do at USC. So I loved going through the old library, because something I should mention was that while I was growing up and listening to all these movies, I became so familiar with the library effects in the different studios that I could tell you almost immediately from hearing a film, I could certainly tell you the studio. That's Paramount. That's Warner Brothers. I'd recognize their Thunderclapper, their Horse Whinny, or their Gunshot from G-Man or something.
Sure.
And I didn't know this would be useful knowledge to have this. But just like the studios had recognizable styles, styles photographically, styles depending on, because of the contract players that they had in their stable, they had styles of sound. And Fox did things different from Columbia and so on. And anyway, so I really jumped at this opportunity to go through the RKO library, because I thought, oh boy, there's probably some history in here. And there was. There were many good tracks from King Kong, for instance.
Wow.
You know, like the monster sounds and the pterodactyl and the brontosaurus and Kong and the screaming men as they're being eaten alive and this sort of thing. And often in the cards that described the sounds were little bits of information that told you something maybe about what it was and how it was done. It was rare that information was there. But when it was, I found that just fascinating. It would say something about the pterodactyl that Kong, you know, crunches up and everything. And it mentions that it's a parrot backwards. You know,
wow.
And that's really true. Later, I got a recording of a parrot and messed around with it. And yeah, you come up with something pretty close to that pterodactyl. So these were things that I was very interested in. And I kept collecting all this knowledge about it. And so I had a reputation at USC as being the one student that was kind of a fanatic with sound. And so, looping around here, Gary Kurtz, when they started planning Star Wars, he and George Lucas, and they both had been former USC graduates. I didn't, you know, before I was there. They called up the department and said, we're looking for some student who's interested in sound. You know, we'd like to hire him to do something for us. And can you recommend anybody? And so I was the number one candidate, you know, and I was just finishing my degree. So it was a good time to look at some employment. And so I was asked to go out to their offices, which were Universal at that time. And this was a year before they even started filming Star Wars. But I went there and met Gary Kurtz and Lucas. And on the wall in the office were all these wonderful paintings by Ralph McQuarrie of art that would be, you know, locations and characters in this film called The Star Wars at the time. And it was Luke Starkiller who was actually the character at that moment. And they wanted me to work on one specific thing, actually. They wanted to work on creating a voice for Chewbacca, the Wookiee. because this was a character that they wanted to know on the set, how would they direct this character? I mean, how would they make the mouth move? And so if we knew what the sound was going to be like, that they would clue them into how to handle the mask and the person, you know, Peter Mayhew, who ended up playing the Wookiee. So it was specifically for the Wookiee that they were looking for someone to collect some material for it. And so they gave me a script. I was hired, you know. I'll mention that. They didn't say so at the time. I left their offices. They were very stone-faced about the whole thing. I wasn't sure that they liked me or anything. But a couple of days later, I got a letter in the mail with a W-2 form to fill out. That's how they started. So my career started, you know, strictly in a bit of paperwork. It said something like, fill out this form, you know. So I did. And that meant, I guess, that I was hired. I think I called up and asked if I was hired, you know. They gave me a Nagra tape recorder and a couple of microphones. And they said, you know, go collect some stuff for the Wookiee. But they sent me a script of Star Wars at that time, and I read it, and of course I was stunned. I thought, this is the film I've always wanted to work on. It combined, you know, science fiction, which I love. It combined westerns, which I loved. It was a swashbuckler. You know, it was a blend of adventure movies and science fiction. I felt I completely understood it. And I saw all these things in the script, you know, Jawas and Darth Vader and TIE fighters and things. So I called them up and I said, well, do you want sounds for all these other items in the film too? And they said, yeah, sure, go ahead. There's a lot of things to work on. So that was sort of a casual way of getting started. So there I was, in my apartment. I was married at the time, and my wife was working as a waitress in a nearby restaurant, and I got a weekly paycheck to go and collect sounds, and that's where it started for me.
Wow. Now, isn't your voice heard on some of these, in some of the Star Wars films?
Well, my voice is heard, I mean, there's, all the films have isolated, you know, pilot lines or PA voice lines, and often I would do one of those. I'm audible. I think I'm Red 11 in the first movie. If you're a pilot that's off screen, this is Red 11. I'm doing this. You never saw me, but I think I got blown up somewhere along the line. But, when it came to, alien voices, I would get more involved. In particular, you might say it's my voice, but it's really, much of it is my voice, but R2-D2, the robot, even though he sounds electronic, and that's true, I ended up doing vocalizations at the same time I play a keyboard on an old ARP synthesizer. And I learned to sort of whistle and beep along with what I was playing on the keyboard. Ah. And through a lot of practice, I would get something that sounded expressive. And I could say, oh, that's R2 saying, come this way. Or he's making a rude remark to 3PO or something. That took a long time. That was the hardest task I had on Star Wars. You know, the first sound I actually ever made for it was a lightsaber. I came up with that basically in 3 or 4 days. I just had an idea for it right away. But R2-D2 took, that was about a year of work of collecting, wow, experimenting, trying to get something. And it was unprecedented in movies to have a talking robot that didn't speak words, but you had to understand the intention, the meaning of what R2 was saying without it being recognizable words in English. So it all depended on making expressive sounds that you understood the intention of. Didn't quite realize that at first, but it was a long path to get to it. Nowadays, because you think you take it for granted, like it would have been easy, but you know, when we made that movie and you had all these crazy voices in it, like R2 and then 3PO, who's doesn't have a moving mouth or no blinking lights or anything, the movie starts out with those two talking. The first couple lines of dialogue are two robots.
Yeah.
And we were seriously worried that the audience would have no idea what's going on. They wouldn't understand that sound was coming from this drinking fountain or whatever R2 is. And there was concerns about that right up until the first time we showed it to an audience.
Now, even something like Darth Vader's voice, clearly you got a voice to do it, but did you create the way that it was going to come across?
Sure. Vader's voice in the script was Vader was described in the script as being having this life support suit on him and keeping him alive, as if he was, you know, he was badly damaged in some way. And so what I did in the early concepts of Vader, I had some clicking, like there was some kind of relays and mechanism associated with him. I thought about the, say, for instance, the crocodile in Peter Pan, yeah. You know, the ticking clock, something like that. Something, some signature that always told you he was around. The script mentioned that he had some kind of breathing apparatus and so on. And so the early concepts of Vader I made up, he was beeping and clicking and breathing, and he sounded like the ER, the whole room at once, you know. It was too much. It was kind of distracting. And we ended up keeping just the breathing. And the breathing is me breathing through a particular scuba tank regulator. I went to a local scuba shop here in Northern California in San Rafael called the Bamboo Reef one evening, and after they had a class where people left, there were numerous tanks and regulators laying around the pool. I just went around and recorded different ones. I would breathe through it, and I had a little tiny microphone, a little Sony ECM50, and I actually put that down inside one of the regulators, so it was extremely close to the valve that opens and closes, and then I breathed through it. And that ended up being the breathing that we used for Vader. It's slightly slowed down from the original recording. So that breathing became his signature. As to the voice, you know, George Lucas was auditioning different people to be the actual, you know, deliver the words. On the set, the voice was delivered by David Prowse, who was in the suit. But he had a strong Welsh accent, and it just wasn't what the character needed. So George eventually picked James Earl Jones. And so the trick was to record James Earl Jones, which we did in an ADR session, which means you're, you know, watching the movie and saying the lines along with the character. And then I combined the breathing and the voice together into one track. And then what I did was take that recording and play it over a speaker and go to different rooms, like a bathroom or a hallway or a lobby somewhere, and re-record the sound again so that the voice and the breathing were now affected by the acoustics of the same room, and that brought them together.
Huh.
So they felt like it was done on the set as one unit of sound. And that, what we call worldizing, which means taking a sound and putting it out there in the real world, is a technique we've used frequently in all the Star Wars films, especially for exotic voices, because you don't want to build something in the studio that's clean and up close to the mic and just perfect. You want to make it seem like it was done on the set. Someone turns their head away from the mic, that you want that impression. And so we would go to pains later to simulate that kind of re-recording of voices. I should go back and say that 3PO originally was going to be Stan Freberg. He was in on the running for it. And we did some tracks with him, and he was good. George wanted this kind of, as he described it, used car salesman feel to it, to 3PO originally. 3PO, the gold robot that does speak English, yeah. was... I originally thought it might, well, was intended maybe for Stan Freberg, and some auditions were done with him, but he was good. But what happened was, is that on the set, when they were doing the movie, Tony Daniels, who plays C-3PO, he's in the suit doing all this wonderful pantomime and body language. Of course, he has a British accent, but you just couldn't reproduce the wonderful coordination of his vocal performance with his body performance. And no one thought of 3PO having a British accent, like some sort of butler or something.
Yeah.
But it just fell together. Tony Daniels made that character work. And so we couldn't find anything to replace that characterization. So the temporary track of Tony was that was used. Oh, we brought him in and, you know, did it all over again and controlled it. So that's how that voice was born. But R2, of course, only beeped and whistled and booped, and still does to this day.
Stan Freberg would have brought a completely different characterization.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would have been...
it's hard to even imagine him with a different voice.
Yeah, of course. Now, especially it's been too long, it's a folklore now, so you can't tamper with it.
Sure.
You
know? But heck, I would have liked to have heard what Freberg did with it.
You know, we should dig out that recording somewhere in the archives.
There's too much to talk to you about, so we'll jump it around a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
I first became aware of your name in 1987 when you worked on Alamo, The Price of Freedom, mm-hmm. because several of the people who were involved were saying, Ben Burtt's doing the sound. He did Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
So I became aware of that. And, I want to talk to you a little bit about that film because obviously the Alamo looms very large in my pathetic life. And, were you supervising the entire film in terms of the sound of the entire film, or did they bring you on for any specific things?
I was hired by Keith Merrill, who was the director and writer, co-writer. I had met him because he had done a film that came to Skywalker Sound called The Grand Canyon.
Yes.
And I was real impressed with the format of IMAX and just had met Keith at one of the screenings of the film and, you know, had a conversation going with him. And so when Alamo came up, I was hired to be the editor of the film as well as the sound designer. So I had a dual responsibility. And so I went to on location for, now I wasn't there the whole time, but I was there for a few weeks and to just make sure that the sound they were recording was done to the way I wanted to. I was going to inherit all the material and put it together. And I wanted to supervise it. And Keith allowed us to do things with sound on the set, which a rare opportunity to do things right, actually. And so I was there. As you know, with IMAX, you're shooting mostly these big wide shots because the format is so tall and it's going to be projected so big. So you can't have a boom microphone hovering above the actors because that would be in the shot. So we had to figure out ways of getting the sound, getting good sound. Of course we can put radio mics on actors, but you know, the costumes they're wearing, and there's also, it's an action movie a lot, they're running and moving. You could get in a little trouble putting lavs on them because they bump it and it's not clear. We did some of that, but one of the things we did on Alamo, which was fun, if you go back and look at the movie, is we would walk into the scene as the sound man, but we would be in costume. Like if you had a Mexican soldier or townsperson, you could have the serape over your recording rig, and so we would walk in the scenes often and be standing next to the main characters as they're talking, and getting the sound back and forth like that. And numerous times I was dressed as a Mexican soldier and charging in with the soldiers. It's just that in a whole group of people. And, you know, such as nighttime and all of this, I was wearing a shako and all the regalia, but I wasn't carrying a flintlock or anything, musket. I was carrying a sound rig, and we were able to get a lot of the sound by being in the shots. Or a couple of times, crazy things happened. There was when they were finally poured over the walls and the fight moved through the courtyard. Mm-hmm. There were tents in the courtyard, pitched in the courtyard, representing, you know, places where the defenders slept, and I went inside one of the tents and set up my recording rig because you couldn't see me, and the tent is, you know, pretty transparent to sound. They're going to run through and they'll be shooting, and I thought, here's a good place to do it. I didn't realize that I had set up next to an explosion, which was just outside the tent, and the pyro guys in that film didn't hold back. You might have heard
they
stories.
Sure did not,
there were.
Yeah.
There was a lot of pretty concussive stuff going on, which looked good on camera, but was kind of dangerous.
Yes, the people were hurt.
There were numerous injuries, I'm afraid to say. They were filling up the Val Verde Hospital weekly. But
one guy, when they blow the doors, when they have the little barricade at the church.
Yeah, right.
The they blow end. That, a guy, a wire went right through
That's
his
right.
face.
No, I know that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
There were some bad things, that happened. I mean, in any case, I was in this little tent, you know, recording, and suddenly this whole place just lit up, you know, and, it was really hot. And I wasn't hurt, but I was, you know, I was certainly surprised. It was, fortunately, it was a movie explosion, which is in a mortar that directs it upward.
Sure.
It looks good. But, you know, that whole experience, what another nice thing that Keith let us do, which helped, was if they had a scene where, oh, somebody rides in on their horse to give a report and gets off his horse and they gather around him and do something, and then they walk off down a wooden sidewalk or something. We would, after they had finished shooting the scene, we were allowed to do the scene just for sound without any dialogue. So we'd have the guy ride up again, get off his horse, you know, jangle his sword or whatever went on, and walk off, or they'd march away. And so we'd get this realistic sound. See, the Alamo, you had a chance to get a lot of authentic sound because everybody had their weapons and their boots and the proper kinds of sounds were happening right there at the time. And so we took advantage of that by having two sound units, one that we did the dialogue and followed the main crew around, and then a second unit, which I was running, which we simulated as many of the scenes for sound only. So when we got all that material back and put it together in post-production, we didn't really do any Foley or some of the things, you know, adding sounds in.
Yeah.
Much of that. We had some really nice wagons and, you know, cavalry galloping through, which, you know, it's hard to get. That's hard to recreate that later.
Sure. You know? Well, did you get all of the gunshots and cannon firing and all that stuff on the set, or did you add to it later on?
We did it two ways. We spent a lot of time taking reenactors with their weapons away from the set and, you know, down the road, so to speak, and recorded their guns. And we did live ammunition, so we could fire muskets, and we put microphones downrange to get the swish of the musket ball in the air, which it does, a kind of whoosh kind of sound, and or you get a whistle or a ricochet off the ground. There was a piece of the set from the old John Wayne movie, you know, a quarter of a mile away from there, sort of a wall and a piece, I guess.
It's like a corner.
Like a corner, right. Yeah. And we would bounce bullets off of that, you know, and get ricochets off the stone. And then there was also a group there that had the cannons, the Napoleonic cannons, the 6-pounders, the 24-pounder. And we rolled that stuff away and fired some live shots and got, the cannonball through the air. None of the artillery in that battle were, they were strictly percussive. They weren't exploding rounds or shells. They were strictly just by the sheer force would hit something. Or I guess they had canister. I'm not sure whether they had that in the battle. But we did a lot, we got a lot of material out there at the location. We even did a lot of the music, the source music of when they're dancing or playing, marching or that sort of thing. We had the musicians there that played the period folk tunes and the playing with spoons and all of that. And we did a lot of recordings of them in a little quarry away from the set. So we came back from location well equipped with live sound to be integrated. And so we did add to the guns and cannons, explosions, things that I had recorded elsewhere over in my own collection. But we had a good foundation, better than you usually get. I feel like that.
Now, you went on to make several IMAX films yourself, right?
Yes.
Was that after this?
Yes, it was. I got very interested in the IMAX format initially because it was the sound, what you could do with sound in it, because they wanted high quality, multi channel sound all around the theaters, and they would allow you to the sound person to play a little more of a visible creative role, you know. So I enjoyed that, and I got involved with another producer director named Graham Ferguson, who's a Canadian, one of the founders of IMAX. And he was doing the space shuttle films. They had worked very hard to get a relationship with NASA, and they were filming the launches of the shuttle and covering behind-the-scenes activity. So I got involved doing the sound for a film called The Dream is Alive first, and that took us on location to do launches and all kinds of sound associated with the training of the astronauts and so on. And that led to them offering me a job to direct one of them called Blue Planet, which was the third IMAX space film, 1989, 1990 in that region. And so I went around the world filming in IMAX subject matter on the ground, which the astronauts were filming from space. Like they were filming the melting of glaciers in Alaska. And so I went to Alaska to do the close-ups, if you want to call it, of the glaciers. Yeah. I had a great adventure doing that. I was traveling all over and for, 2 years there, filming material. We started a second film on the space telescope, the Hubble telescope, and we went into the White Rooms in Sunnyvale, California, to film the building of the telescope. You know, so here I was getting into space now, getting closer to the real thing, which is sort of where I had started back in college. I had been taken off into the science fiction world of space, and now I was, curving back now to the reality. So I found that really a privileged kind of position to be in. I'd do a Star Wars film, then I'd turn around and do a space shuttle movie. Reality versus complete fantasy was kind of interesting.
I talked a little bit about this with Craig when I interviewed him for the podcast, Craig Barron. But you two have been doing these Academy presentations for quite a long time, and I wanted to get your take on how that got started, because those things are always terrific. I've seen as many of them as I could.
Sure. I knew Craig Barron. He was in the mat department at ILM, the Lucasfilm effects facility, and he was the cinematographer shooting the matte paintings when they had that department going. And then later he formed his own company called Matte World and did outstanding work for quite a long time up here based in Northern California. And so I knew Craig. I knew him better because the two of us ended up in a gymnastics class together back in the 80s. It was an evening adult class, and we wanted to be, we were trying to get in shape, and I had done some gymnastics in college, and I guess Craig had too. So we ran into each other at this class, and we discovered we had a love of film history together. I think it came about because while we were doing some of these stunts in gymnastics, we started talking about Burt Lancaster and Nick Cravat, Flame and the Arrow and, those
Crimson Pirate.
And we were jokingly seeing ourselves as the swashbuckling duo, doing flips and things. We weren't as good as Nick and Burt, but at least I had the name Burt. That was good.
Yeah.
So that began our association of just talking about film history and our love of the background behind the scenes of film. And so years go by and we have our careers going and, opportunities, came up to, present, a program at the Academy. It was, The Adventures of Robin Hood, and it kind of started because, of course, I love that film. And both of us were members of the Academy, and it kind of started by saying, gee, Craig, wouldn't you like to see a good print of Robin Hood? How could we see it? Well, if we do a show about it, they'll have to get one, and then we'll see it on the big screen. I hear they're restoring it. So that's kind of the motive was, what film do you want to see? And let's make up a program about it. But the interesting thing is that The Oscar for special effects, when it was first formed up in 1938, the Academy defined it, if you were to get an Oscar for special effects, it actually included a sound person. They saw the category of special effects as being broken into two parts. One was visual effects, and the other was audible effects. Because they knew that if a film had visual effects in it, you know, hurricanes or a tornado or, you know, a monster like King Kong or something. They knew that there would be sounds that would have to be created to go along to support these visual effects. So they saw the duality of the two crafts. And so Craig Knight sort of took that idea and said, okay, let's do programs at the Academy where we pick out a movie and Craig, you talk about the visual effects and I'll research and talk about the audible effects in that film because there's a relationship between the two in terms of creating the overall illusions in the film. So that's how it began. And we kept trying to come up with new ideas, you know, since then. We've done about 10 programs, I think, at this point.
Well, I have some films to suggest that you do next. So
I want your list. Let me know because we're hard pressed to. We've gone through our first wave, you know, of things. But it's for us. We love the excuse and the motivation to go dig into history, and we've always found that. Even if you don't know much about a film, if you start opening the doors and finding, is there anybody that remembers something or is there an old paper written on it or sure. Find somebody with stills or something or recordings, you've done a lot of that yourself, much more. That's a fun road to go. It's a voluntary thing for us, so it's a little hard to squeeze in sometimes around our other responsibilities.
We almost worked on the same project, and by that I mean you worked on the project and I was hovering around the periphery, which was the restoration of Wings. Mm-hmm. And that'd be fun to talk about a little bit because I've always said, and I think I'm right, that Wings is a sound film, not a silent film.
Yeah.
It was released as a sound film.
Uh-huh.
And in its original releases, it had sound effects, music score, but the sound effects were major because even in some of the reviews, it says the music provides a nice accompaniment to the sound effects.
That's right. It does say, yeah, I underlined that, yeah, when I read that. No one's ever said that before.
And then they immediately made a sound print,
yeah,
to go around, but, we really don't have any record. Do we specifically of what the sound effects were like? It was pretty much you had to intuit what.
Obviously we put on an effort to search right away. Has anything survived that is audio from any of those versions of Wings? And in the time and efforts that were spent during that restoration, nothing came up. That doesn't mean someday somebody's going to, you know, find something on a shelf somewhere.
I
expect it to happen after we were all done. That would be the right time to have it show up. But we tried. I mean, there were records from the standpoint of music. At Paramount, the music, they went into all the research they had for, you know, what surviving bits of score are there and how is it made up. That's pretty well documented, I think, on the DVD, the Blu-ray. Sound effects, there very little came about. It seemed to have the sounds took different forms at different times. You know, if you read the reviews or follow it, like you said, the initial roadshow version of Wings playing in New York City had a large orchestra. Some of the sound effects, like explosions and machine guns, were covered by the orchestra with drums, with snare drum, possibly other percussion effects. But there's a lot of mention of machinery being brought on stage that simulated the sounds of airplanes. And
yeah,
you read in some cases it says there were airplane engines on stage, and that's hard to believe because you would have poisoned everyone with fumes. It would have been incredibly loud and uncontrollable. I don't see how you could have done that. But I think what they're saying is that devices were built.
Yeah,
that whirred away with maybe they had a propeller spinning or something. I've never been able to find out exactly what they're talking about.
I haven't either, and I've looked and looked and looked.
Yeah.
Because we know the guy who invented the machine, And, of course, I can't remember his name.
Is it Roy Pomeroy?
No.
Okay, because he's claimed to do some of that.
Yeah. But there was a guy who had a sound effects machine. And, for instance, when they did the world premiere in San Antonio, he and the guy in charge of the Magnascope showed up 2 days before. And it said in the articles because it took them each 2 days to set up.
Oh, really?
What they had to do. He, in another article, I found that the guy was able to replicate different kinds of planes so that there was difference between the German and the American planes and all that stuff. But I'm still not completely sure what this was.
I know. It's very mysterious.
Yeah.
There's always this mention, like you say, of particular sound effects artists or experts being brought in. There's mention that in some cases, I'll give you other data that I came across, maybe to be verified another time, but they had turntables at one point as the technology got a little further along. They had record turntables with pre-recorded sounds, like, say, the airplane, different airplane engines, which you could drop the needle down and play sound along, and that could be amplified and brought into the auditorium. There are specific mentions of having four people on stage, each with a turntable and records. And there's a story written up of, in David Sarnoff's, he was what the founder of NBC.
Yeah.
As a young man, he was sent out because he worked for RCA Victor, I guess. He was sent out to the airfield in New Jersey to record some airplane engines for Wings. And now I've never been able to find a verification of, you know, are there disc recordings around? Who knows? It even goes as far as saying that there were prints eventually with sound on the prints. Music and sound effects. And you can see that could have happened, you know, maybe late 1928, 29, somewhere in there.
29 is when it happened.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So you get an evolution, I think, from completely live people on stage with instruments and sound effects tools. And it, in other places, you get a people playing sound on disc, and somewhere along the line, you get a soundtrack on the film. And it's, and gosh, it'd be fun to find that, but there's been no.
I would love to find it. Up, a know? To find out what the sound effects were on the sound film.
Yeah.
And B to find out what the score was, because apparently it was not the original score.
Uh huh. There's lots of stories, right?
Yeah. We saw it in Spain when there was a Wellman retrospective at the San Sebastian Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And they played it with the original score, mm-hmm. with a full orchestra, and backstage they had a machine gun of some kind, maybe a prop machine gun or something, but it made the sound.
Sure.
And then they had a propeller.
Uh-huh.
So periodically the propeller would go and you would hear it, and so that was their own version of trying to account for this. I think explosions were just bass drum or timpani or something like that. So but it's funny how some things will be documented to a T.
Yeah.
And then some things like this sound machine for the premiere of Wings and the roadshow. Of all that was written about that, and they emphasize the sound over and over and over, and yet nobody ever specifically says what this thing was.
It's frustrating.
Yeah.
I went through the same process of it's and it's frequently mentioned in reviews of the film. Just about always they'll say something about the sound effects, and so it obviously caught people's attention.
Yeah.
And
it was a big selling point.
Right. Yeah. So what is the mystery? I wish I had the answer. You know, when it came to putting a track on the restoration, I think you asked about that. You know, what was the approach? Well, what I tried to do was imagine what the film would have sounded like had Paramount done it, you know, on film. You know, what would be the style and what would be the kind of coloration of, you know, what would they emphasize? So I just took as my model the earliest sound films that I'm familiar with from that time that had airplanes in them, you know, Dawn Patrol 1930, you know, The Eagle and the Hawk, which is at Paramount 33, I'm not sure. You and I saw Young Eagles at one point, and that gave me some, you know, other kind of clues. And so I went back and,
and Hell's Angels, too.
And Hell's Angels, yeah. Exactly, which has a lot of excellent sound. I tried to make it sound like Hell's Angels, I suppose, more than anything else in terms of that was early. I think Hell's Angels was played back both on disc as well as sound on film. I think it had both. I've read maybe that it had both kinds of track, and you can hear that film. I used a lot of vintage recordings, you know, in my years of collecting, even going back to those RKO material, which was at USC. That had all the biplanes from King Kong in it, you know, sort of clean versions of them flying overhead. You'd recognize it immediately.
Sure.
And so I went into those collections where I had obtained old vintage recordings and began to use some of that. So I could kind of say that's the texture of the airplane sounds at the time and machine guns. I've also over the years recorded lots of biplanes and lots of, I directed a film called Attack of the Hawkmen. It was a young indie, TV movie.
Yes.
And it was all about Richthofen and Zeppelins and Anthony Fokker. And we filmed all kinds of aerial dogfights. And I had access at that time to several, absolutely vintage planes that had the actual weapons on board that we could fire, you know, with the canvas belt, machine guns, and all of that sort of thing, and the rotary engines. And so I got a good library of what you'd say the most real of the sounds, and I blended that in with the vintage recordings. But also you wanted to recognize the Hollywood version of things. You know, airplanes always whine when they go down in a spin, and there's bullet ricochets all over the place and so on. So we cheated a little bit because we did the Blu-ray in 5.1 stereo. But I couldn't help myself. So it's yet another version by another artist. You know, you say,
sure,
this is my version of what I think it would, it pays tribute to what I think would be a simulation of what it is.
Well, in this case, we have no way of knowing precisely what
right.
that was. So you may as well, while honoring the heritage and the vintage of it, still make it as effective as you can. I mean, that's the only sensible thing to do.
Yeah, we tried to honor the where the sounds may have occurred and so on. But once you start doing it, you kind of owe it to the audience to have some rules about it. You know, what are you going to hear and what are you not going to hear? You know, we tried not to hear voices of any kind. You know, originally I had a lot of soldiers yelling in the battles. We took that all out. Somebody made the good suggestion is that that's not, you know, that's dialogue in a sense. We take that out. And there was the debates about, you know, how much of it we should do. But, you know, I was happy with the result. It's such a fun film to be a part
sure.
of. My gosh, it was an honor to have that on the screen in front of me and go through it frame by frame, adding sounds where necessary.
Yeah, it was quite a project, and I was glad. I mean, I'm only in the documentary, but it's...
You should have been all over that. But,
I begged them to let me do a commentary track. It would have been so great.
Of course. I don't know all the corporate reasons for the decisions, but that's a...
I might do one yet. What do you think of that?
Of course. I think you should. You're the expert.
I would keep talking to you for the next 2 days if I could, but I realize you actually have a life to lead, so we should stop. And we'll just pick it up again one of these days because there's way more that we need to talk about.
Yeah, we probably missed a few chapters along
the way. Oh, man. Missed a few, I think, yeah. But nevertheless,
okay.
we need to call it a halt this time. So, Ben, thank you so much. This has been so great. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Me too, Frank.
How I enjoyed that conversation with Ben Burt and how I enjoyed the rest of the day as he showed us around the Skywalker Ranch. Believe me, until you've seen the main library in this huge building that looks like a plantation building or something, it's really wonderful. You ain't lived. This thing is really something. And Ben, knowing about my predilection for Foreign Legion material, had pulled all the research materials that they have from the Paramount files out to show me. So After the interview and after a nice tour of the buildings and after a nice lunch, we walked over there and I was greeted with a big pile of Foreign Legion things to look through. So, perfect day? I believe it was. You can look for Ben's movies on his author page on the commentary track. While you're there, I hope that you'll also order a copy of The Lost Remake of Beaugest, my documentary, which is now available on DVD, and I believe will delight young and old alike. Also, while you're there, you can buy others of my books and videos that I've had something to do with, either I produced or directed, or I'm just on the commentary tracks, or something, sometimes just in a documentary. For instance, Ben and I talked about working on Wings, and of course he did the sound design for the restoration last year, and I'm on the making of documentary that's on the Blu-ray, and so I hope that you will get that. I think it's a real delight. I want to thank, of course, my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for their wonderful music. James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Please visit them both often. And please tell people about this podcast. Really need to spread the word. And it helps if you go on iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. I've gotten some really delightful reviews from people, and I am so proud to have them. I really am. And somebody this week made a donation toward the commentary track, and I am incredibly grateful for that. If you want to follow suit, and I know that you do, you should just go to thecommentarytrack.com, and there's a button right there on the homepage that says Donate. It'll take you right to PayPal, and there you go. It's so easy. It's so easy, like taking candy from a baby. So we have another good one coming up next week, although I must say, to be quite candid, that because next week is CineCon, and I will be there from Thursday to the following Monday, watching terrific movies and less than terrific movies, but at least incredibly rare movies. So I will be having the time of my year there. I always love CineCon. And that might mean that I get thrown off a day or two for posting the next commentary track. So please bear with me, if you will. But in the meantime, even if I don't get it up on Sunday night for your listening pleasure on Monday morning, I hope that you won't worry, because we're going to fix it in post.